Well, it seems like even though the world is being decimated of frogs, there's still some left because one of them was in my throat. First article. The Palin Pregene Alliance predicted in the Book of Revelations. This is by Andy Borowitz, writing on Smirking Chimp. The beauty queens prefigure the end of the days. Just hours after Alaska Governor Sarah Palin voiced her support for embattled Miss California, Carrie Pregene, biblical scholars noted that the alliance between the former and present beauty queens is prophesied in the Holy Scriptures. While many observers have called the Palin-Pregene link-up predictable, few suspected that it was in fact predicted in the Book of Revelations. Quote, the unholy alliance between Sarah Palin and Carrie Pregene is explicitly stated in the Book of Revelations as a harbinger of the end of days. This was said by the Reverend Dr. Davis Logsdon, Dean of the University of Minnesota's School of Divinity. They're right in there after the four horsemen of the apocalypse. But Dr. Logsdon was quick to point out that the first person to notice the Palin-Pregene referenced in the Bible's Book of Prophecy was actually the 16th century seer Nostradamus, legendary for his predictive powers. According to Dr. Logsdon, in 1555, Nostradamus predicted the alliance between the two right-wing beauties when he wrote, quote, the slayer of beasts shall meet the bearer of breasts, close quote. When asked whether the alliance between Governor Palin and Miss California means that the world is about to end, Dr. Logsdon was unequivocal. That would be the best-case scenario. Next article is from the American Free Press. Investigation begins. Did senior U.S. officials swindle the Iraqi government out of $50 billion? It's by Patrick Cockburn. He's a writer based in Britain. In what could turn out to be the greatest fraud in U.S. history, American authorities have started to investigate the alleged role by senior military officers in the misuse of billions of dollars in a U.S.-directed effort to reconstruct Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. The exact sum missing may never be clear, but a report suggests that it may exceed $50 billion, making it an even bigger theft than Bernard Madoff's notorious Ponzi scheme. One U.S. businessman who was active in Iraq since 2003 stated, I believe the real looting of Iraq after the invasion was by U.S. officials and contractors, not by the people from the slums of Baghdad. In one case, auditors working for SIGIR discovered that $57 million was sent in a pallet upon pallet of $100 bills to the U.S. Controller for South Central Iraq, Robert J. Stein, Jr., who had himself photographed standing with a mound of money. He's among the few U.S. officials who were in Iraq to be convicted of fraud and money laundering. One of the few visible signs of government work in Baghdad infrastructure is a tireless attention to planting palm trees and flowers in the center strip between main roads. Those are then dug up and replanted a few months later. Iraqi leaders are convinced that the theft or waste of huge sums of U.S. and Iraqi government money could have happened only if U.S. senior officials were themselves involved in the corruption. In 2004 and 5, the entire Iraqi military procurement budget of $1.3 billion was siphoned off from the Iraqi Defense Ministry in return for 28-year-old Soviet helicopters, too obsolete to fly, and armored cars easily penetrated by rifle bullets. I have to really wonder there, what are we doing sending Soviet helicopters to Iraq? Back to the article. Iraqi officials were blamed for the theft, but U.S. military officials were largely in control of the defense ministry at the time and must have been either highly negligent or participants in the fraud. My commentary for today, May 20th. By the way, in case you've forgotten, past rabble-rousing shows are posted on the KVMR website, so you can listen to them 24/7. Tell your friends, relatives, and anyone who doesn't agree with you to give a listen. First item, I don't know about you, but I'm having a hard time taking politics or the news seriously. Take our economic meltdown. By now, we all should know that any investment in the stock market is gambling, pure and simple. You're gambling that a piece of what used to be a piece of paper and is now simply a computer entry, supposedly representing something real, like a company or a commodity, will change value. Either bet it'll go up, or if you're more of a gambler, bet it'll go down. It's not quite as simple as betting whether the Sacramento Kings will ever win another basketball game, or whether the guy sitting across the table from you holds a better poker hand than you, but it's still gambling. But the more one reads of the high rollers gambling on housing loans, currency swaps, derivatives, and the whole flim-flam of derivatives and other cute words describing betting, that something essentially worthless will increase or decrease in its phony value, then compounding the scam by trying to hide the whole scam by bundling the worthless paper into bundles and selling the pony crap to gullible fools who are worse gamblers than you are. It's hilarious and ludicrous. KVMR broadcaster Mark Cuniberti and others have dissected this mess ad infinitum. But reduced to basics, ask yourself one simple question. What of real value does this entire economic system produce? All this shifting around of computer entries, fraudulently labeled as assets, does it produce anything of real value? Put any food on anyone's table? Roofs over families' heads? Products we can use? Answer, nada, zip, and zilch. Let's look at this whole business of living on borrowed capital. This whole infatuation with loans and credit cards. My parents taught me one simple truth. If you can't pay cash for it, you don't deserve to have it, and you can't have it, period. Earn the money, then buy the thing you desire. What's that? You can't afford a new car like the Joneses? Aw, that's so sad. Buy a used car you can afford. The sole exception was for a house. And then be damn careful if you go into debt for that single item. Make sure you can pay it off. Debt is bondage. The second truth I've learned is that everything you own owns you. No exceptions. First, it costs you to obtain it. And then it costs you to maintain it. And if it appears valuable to others, it costs you to protect it. Living beyond one's means is a constant struggle. A quote from the legendary philosopher Lenny Bruce. Any man of religion who owns more than one suit is a hustler. Translation. If you got more than you need, you're awfully close to greed. Back to our gambling analogy. The elite, the big players, are playing with your money, not theirs. It's a great game. If they win, they keep the spoils. If they lose, the taxpayer, who in case you've forgotten is you, bails them out. They never lose. It's a great game. Unfortunately, you are on the losing side, and your elected representatives are doing all in their power to keep it that way. Hooray for elected representation, American style. Next item. And now for the latest media non-news story. Did the CIA lie to Nancy Pelosi and Congress? And if so, when? Who cares? Of course they did. It's their job to cover up, to misinform, and when all else fails, to blatantly lie. It's their job, for God's sakes. It's what they're hired, trained, and paid to do. Why expect anything else? But the real reason why the entire hissy fit catfight is in the news is to once again divert the public's attention from the real issue, which is, does Congress have the huevos to do the right thing and put on trial the Bush officials and legal advisors who authorized, condoned, and encouraged torture? Will officials and agents of the U.S. government be held accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity? It's a simple question, really, which is why the government and compliant corporate media offers us the circus of she lied, he lied, they lied. Nancy, baby, of course they lied to you. Stop the public sniveling. Are you going to put the bastards on trial or aren't you? And if not, will you please resign your position of pretend leadership so we can get someone in your place who will lead us back to ethical, accountable governance? Lead or get the hell out of the way. But this is American politics, so of course we all know how this latest non-issue will end. A bipartisan pronouncement that it was all a misunderstanding. No one is at fault, but don't worry, it will never happen again. Until next time. Next item. We're not the only great bastion of Western civilization whose government is soiling its underwear in public. The British have discovered, gasp, that some of their cabinet ministers have been stealing from the public treasury. False expense claims and the like. Only one significant difference in politics across the pond and here. In Britain, when a government official is revealed to be a crook or woefully incompetent, they offer public apology and resign. Over here, they remain in their position, remains silent while some other official covers for them by uttering the meaningless platitude, "Mistakes may have been made, but it won't happen again. Trust us." The miscreant is then soon promoted or retires on a cushy pension to be then hired by the corporation that benefited from his foul deeds. Next item. The latest out of Washington. Obama is mandating that the floundering U.S. auto industry finally be forced to produce vehicles that will compete with foreign makes. The industry scaremongers are hilarious. They point out that the new regulations, not in force until 2016, by the way, will raise the price of their vehicles by an average of, get this, a whopping $1,300. Have you checked the sticker price of Detroit Iron lately? Their cheapest start at maybe $12,000 and go up to maybe $60,000. So that $1,300 increase is pennies added to the full price. Then, when you factor in that very few buyers pay cash, but rather make payments over years, that threatened $1,300 increase is rendered completely insignificant. More BS from the big three car makers. Next item. Here's today's query for you legal experts out there. A friend of mine noticed that whenever he boots up his computer, Microsoft has sent a personal notice that his Windows XP is not genuine. Zounds and gadzooks! Notify Homeland Security. Of course, he'd like to get rid of the annoying message, which stops his boot up until he clicks piss off. But in a larger view, how does Microsoft know? Obviously, they can peer into his computer. Is this not legally an invasion of his privacy? Or has he given Microsoft and whoever else permission to hack into his computer? If Microsoft can do it, of course others can as well. So the question is, who can and by what legal authority? If Bill Gates can, the government can. And just to stretch the point, theoretically, terrorists also could. The scoundrels could place incriminating emails and plans for bombs and terrorists acts onto your computer. This could lead to an interesting defense in court. An accused terrorist could claim that they are not responsible for any incriminating evidence found on their computer, as the government had access to it and could have planted the evidence. Round and round we go, and where this merry-go-round stops, nobody knows. Okay, that's my commentary for today. Now for some other folks' commentary. How Americans Think About Torture and Why. It's by Roy Edelson, smirkingchimp.com. In recent weeks, new revelations about the harsh interrogation and torture of detainees during the Bush administration years have made headlines and stirred controversy. The positions of prominent advocates and opponents on each side are clear. But what do we know about how the American people in general have come to view the use of torture by the U.S. government? The Pew Research Center for the People and the Press has been polling Americans on this key question for almost 5 years. Since 2004, representative samples have been asked, do you think the use of torture against suspected terrorists in order to gain important information can often be justified, sometimes be justified, or rarely be justified, or never be justified? The results over this time period have shown only minor fluctuations. The most recent numbers reveal that half those polled considered torture justified at least some of the time, and fully 71% refused to rule it out entirely. The article then cites two more polls, which I'll admit. They say the same things. Based on this sampling of polling results, it's easy at first to be surprised and troubled by the degree to which Americans have expressed support for the inhumane treatment and torture of detainees. But public sentiment on such matters does not emerge in a vacuum. Rather, it often reflects the influence of carefully orchestrated marketing campaigns by powerful vested interests eager to shape opinion in support of a specific agenda or facts on the ground. Certainly, it is now well known that the Bush administration embraced the use of enhanced interrogation techniques in national security settings. It is therefore instructive to carefully consider the five-pronged message that they and their backers promoted to create a citizenry supportive of torture. The first component involved fostering a war on terror environment of pervasive fear in which the prospect of massive catastrophic harm was repeatedly given center stage. Spurred on by improbable ticking time bomb scenarios where every second matters, perceptions of an urgent need to promote the country, to protect the country from looming disaster, created a whatever-it-takes mentality in which efforts to extract crucial information through harsh interrogations and torture became a no-brainer. My comment. Remember Condi Rice citing the specter of nuclear mushroom clouds over American cities? Back to the article. The second element advanced the view that we need not be helpless against this threat, because through torture, and torture alone, we can learn what we need to foil the plans of evildoers. Unsubstantiated evidentiary claims, hidden from inspection by veils of secrecy, were used to argue that specific interrogation techniques, regardless of how they might repulse us, were ultimately the only way we could protect ourselves. Third was the frequent assurance that those we subjected to torture were themselves guilty of having participated in heinous acts of injustice that caused the loss of many innocent lives. This argument served to diminish concerns that the public might have felt over the treatment these individuals received while in custody. Even in the absence of legal proceedings, the detainees could be deemed deserving of the physical and psychological pain inflicted upon them. They were responsible for their own suffering. Fourth was the repeated assertion that the United States had a finely tuned moral compass and engages in torture only with regret and discomfort, only as a last resort, and only on the surface of a far greater good. Sharp contrasts were drawn between them and us, between the detainees' innate evilness and our inherent goodness, between their vile aims and our righteous purpose. In this context, the interrogators were presented as courageous and heroic, worthy of praise rather than criticism. The fifth and final component was a concerted effort to stifle open debate when questions about the use of enhanced interrogation techniques arose. Standard strategy here involved painting skeptics and critics, including human rights leaders and organizations, as untrustworthy, irresponsible, misinformed, weak, or unpatriotic. In doing so, the public was encouraged to discount, ignore, or condemn those voices of concern, and important words of warning, therefore, went unheeded. In sum, this seemingly successful campaign of mass persuasion depended upon convincing the public to believe five things. 1. Our country is in great danger. 2. Torture is the only thing that can keep us safe. 3. The people we torture are monstrous wrongdoers. 4. Our decision to torture is moral and for the greater good. And 5. Critics of our torture policy should not be trusted. And all the while, the marketeers painstakingly avoided using the actual word torture and contested the word's use by anyone else. Of course, this strategy is by no means unique to the selling of torture. A similar approach, designed for hawking war, was used with devastating and tragic effect in building public support for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Admittedly, we cannot be sure that torture would be less popular with Americans today if the Bush administration had not worked so hard to promote it, but there's good reason to think that this might be the case. After all, the combination of an outsized public relations budget, an overly accommodating mainstream media, and an unwary audience of millions is every marketeer's dream. In similar fashion, we cannot really know whether there would now be an even greater public support for torture if not for the efforts of those who have steadfastly spoken out against our country's interrogation abuses. Looking ahead, as still more information emerges through declassification of documents, high-level investigations, or congressional hearings, we should expect to hear this five-part sales pitch over and over again from Bush-era torture advocates. But hopefully, the next time around, far fewer of us will still be buying. Okay, I want to find you an article that illustrates at least one of the people being tortured. What did I do with it? Give me a second here. Okay, can't find it. Too bad. I'll have to read it to you next time, but it was an article that was talking about one of the Guantanamo detainees and the fact that he was in Guantanamo because he was a janitor. And somehow, this was in Pakistan, and somehow they discovered that he had gone to a website that was a satirical website that had a satirical article on how to make an H-bomb. And the article was really, if you look at the article, it was hysterically funny because you're supposed to pressurize aluminum and you could use a bicycle pump to pressurize it. And then you needed a centrifuge, and for a centrifuge, you could put it in a bucket with a string on the handle of the bucket and swing it around your head very fast. So the article was obviously a joke. This poor Pakistani janitor was somehow the CIA found out that he had gone to this website. That was the basis for imprisoning him in Pakistan. He was tortured. He finally revealed all sorts of things, and now he's in Guantanamo as a result of that. So as far as using torture to save lives, very suspicious. I wish I could find the article, but I left it at home. All right, next article. No, here it is. Huh. Okay, Obama's now faced with a sticky question of what to do with the prisoners if he closes Guantanamo. Travis D. Hipp made the point this morning that if these prisoners were transferred to the U.S., none of these guys could be tried, as their confessions were all extracted under torture, and so the evidence would be thrown out of court, and there's no other evidence. At some point, one must ask just who are these guys, and after years in captivity, do they really represent a threat to anyone? Well, here's the story of one of the prisoners. It's by Jason Lewis. It was published in the London Daily Mail online. It was revealed last February that a British resident held in Guantanamo Bay was identified as a terrorist after confessing he'd visited a joke website on how to build a nuclear weapon. Binyam Mohammed, a former UK asylum seeker, admitted to having read the instructions after allegedly being beaten, hung up by his wrists for a week, and having a gun held to his head in a Pakistani jail. It was this confession that apparently convinced the CIA that they were holding a top-level Al-Qaeda terrorist. But the Mail on Sunday can reveal that the offending article, called How to Build an H-Bomb, was first published in a U.S. satirical magazine and later placed on a series of websites. Written by Barbara Ehrlich-Reich, the publication's food editor, Rolling Stone journalist Peter Biskin, and scientist Michio Kaku, it claims that a nuclear weapon can be made using a bicycle pump and with liquid uranium poured into a bucket and swung round. Despite its clear satirical bent, the story led the CIA to accuse 30-year-old Mohammed, a caretaker, of plotting a dirty bomb attack before subjecting him to its extraordinary rendition program. During his 8-year imprisonment, Mohammed has allegedly been flown to secret torture centers in Pakistan, Morocco, an American-run jail known as the Dark Prison near Kabul in Afghanistan, and finally to Guantanamo Bay. The British Foreign Secretary, Mr. Miliband, is refusing to release classified documents relating to Mohammed's detention. Last week, the British High Court ruled that the 42 intelligence papers must remain secret. However, the judges insisted they had no choice because the government had informed them of a threat by the U.S., to withdraw all intelligence cooperation with Britain if the papers were published by the court. A little bit of coercion there. Mr. Miliband was then forced to defend the claim in the House of Commons, insisting that the U.S. needed confidence that its secrets are safe with us. However, details of what Mohammed told his interrogators, unearthed by this newspaper, are likely to cast further doubt on Mr. Miliband's stance. We can reveal that the story, which apparently led to Mohammed's ordeal, could not possibly have been used by a terrorist to build a nuclear weapon. The satirical article, published in 7 Days magazine, says its authors were given 3 days to cook up a workable H-bomb. They did, and we've decided to share the culinary secrets with you. It adds, not that 7 Days supports nuclear terrorism. We don't. We would prefer to die from familiar poisons like low-level radiation, microwaves, DDT, or food dyes, rather than unexpectedly, say as a hostage to Latvian nationalists brandishing a homemade bomb. The recipe is highly detailed and plainly ridiculous. The prospective bomb maker is instructed to transform uranium gas into liquid by subjugating it to pressure, adding, you can use a bicycle pump for this. The instructions continue. Then make a simple home centrifuge. Fill a standard-sized bucket 1/4 full of liquid uranium hexafluoride. Attach a 6-foot rope to the bucket handle. Now swing the rope and attach bucket around your head as fast as possible. Keep this up for about 45 minutes. Slow down gradually and very gently put the bucket on the floor. The uranium-235, or uranium isotope, which can be used to cause an explosive chain reaction, will have risen to the top, where it can be skimmed off like cream. Repeat this step until you have the required 10 pounds of uranium. Last night, Muhammad's lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, confirmed that the article was central to claims that his client was planning a dirty bomb attack. Unclassified evidence corroborates Binyam's claims that he was threatened. At the time, the White House was obsessed by the idea terrorists had access to nuclear materials, he added. Binyam said that he told them about a website he had once seen on the Internet called How to Build an H-Bomb. He said that this was a joke, but they thought it might be serious. I'm speculating, but I think this news was sent up the line to the White House, which is when the paranoia kicked in. They authorized the enhanced interrogation techniques against Binyam, including the rendition. This is how they made their huge mistake, thinking he was a major terrorist as opposed to a London janitor. It explains why they took a nobody and subjected him to the worst torture of any U.S. prisoner in the past 7 years. The time is 12:29 p.m., the place is Nevada City, California. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamberlain. Next article is by Dave Lindorf, writing in SmirkingChimp.com. Caught in a lie, U.S. is using white phosphorus in Afghanistan as a weapon. When doctors started reporting that some of the victims of the U.S. bombing of several villages in Farah province last week, an attack that left between 117 and 147 civilians dead, most of them women and children. They were turning up with deep, sharp burns on their bodies that looked like they'd been caused by white phosphorus. The U.S. military was quick to deny responsibility. U.S. officials, who initially denied that the U.S. had even bombed any civilians in Farah, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, including massive craters where houses had once stood, insisted that, quote, "No white phosphorus," close quote, was used in the attack on several villages in Farah. Official military policy on the use of white phosphorus is to only use the high-intensity, self-igniting material as a smokescreen during battles, or to illuminate targets, not as a weapon against human beings, even enemy troops. Now that policy, and the military's blanket denial that phosphorus was used in Farah, have to be questioned, thanks to a recent report filed from a remote area of Afghanistan by a New York Times reporter, C.J. Cheevers, writing in the May 14th edition of the New York Times in an article headlined, "Korangal Valley Memo, in Bleak Afghanistan Outpost, Troops Slog On." He wrote of how an embattled U.S. Army unit in the Korangal Valley of Afghanistan had come under attack following a morning memorial service for one of their members, who had been killed the day before by a mine, Cheevers wrote. After the ceremony, the violence resumed. The soldiers detected a Taliban spotter on a ridge, which was pounded by mortars and then white phosphorus rounds from a 155mm howitzer. What did the insurgents do? When the smoldering subsided, they attacked from exactly the same spot, shelling the outpost with 30mm grenades and putting the soldiers on notice that the last display of firepower had little effect. The Americans escalated. An A-10 aircraft made several gun runs, then dropped a 500-pound bomb. It's clear from this passage that the military's use of the phosphorus shells... Oh, that was in quotes. It's clear from this passage that the military's use of phosphorus shells had not been for the officially sanctioned purpose of providing cover. The soldiers had no intention of climbing that hill to attack the spotter on the ridge themselves. They were trying to destroy him with shells and bombs. In fact, the last thing they would have wanted to do is provide the spotter with a smoke cover, which would have helped him escape, and which also would have hidden him from the planes which had been called in to make gun runs at his position. Nor was this a case of illuminating the target. The incident, as Cheever's reports, took place in daylight. Clearly, then, this article shows that it is routine for soldiers to call in phosphorus rounds to attack enemy soldiers, which is supposed to be against U.S. military policy for this material. Whoever was manning the howitzer had a stock of the weapons on hand and was ready to fire them. The U.S. initially flatly denied using white phosphorus weapons in Iraq. Then reports first began to come out, including from U.S. troops themselves, that they had been used extensively against insurgents defending the city of Fallujah against U.S. Marines in November of 2004. Under mounting pressure, the Pentagon first admitted that it had used the chemical in Fallujah, but only, quote, for illumination. Later, the Pentagon added that it had used phosphorus as a screen to hide troops. But finally, in 2005, the Pentagon was forced to admit that it also used white phosphorus directly as a weapon against enemy Iraqi troops in the assault on Fallujah, a city of 300,000 people that still held many civilians. The same pattern of denial and eventual admission regarding the use of this controversial and deadly weapon by U.S. forces now seems to be repeating itself in Afghanistan. It is odd that given the controversy over the use of white phosphorus weapons, which results in terrible wounds and eventual death, as phosphorus particles burn their way down through flesh to the bone and sometimes straight outward through the body, leaving a charred channel of destruction. The New York Times Cheevers, or perhaps his editors back in New York, ignored any mention of the issue while reporting on the use of the chemical rounds to attack a lone spotter on the ridge. Given the current controversy over whether the U.S. used white phosphorus shells or bombs in Fala Province only days before, it's hard to understand why the issue wasn't mentioned in this particular article. Indeed, in the online version of the story, the word phosphorus is set as a hot link to an article on the controversy over the battlefield use of phosphorus, indicating that at least someone at the Times has integrity and good news sense. As for the U.S. government and the Pentagon, it's clear that they know the weapon is a vicious and controversial one, and that besides causing horrific and painful wounds, it is profoundly dangerous for innocent civilians, particularly when used in towns or village settings. It's bad enough that the U.S. is using this weapon. It's even worse that it's forced to lie about it. Surely if the goal of U.S. policy is to win the hearts and minds of Afghanistan's people, it shouldn't be using a weapon that causes such terrible and indiscriminate wounds. Then again, maybe winning those hearts and minds isn't the goal. Maybe, as in the so-called pacification program applied by U.S. forces in rural South Vietnam, the goal is to terrorize Afghan villagers in Taliban regions into rejecting the Taliban in their midst. Requests for answers from the press office at the Pentagon and at military headquarters in Afghanistan regarding U.S. policy on the use of white phosphorus and on the specific use of the shells mentioned by the New York Times article were ignored. Dave Lindorf, writing in Smirking Chimp. The next one's called Capitalism's Greatest Hits. It's by Stephen Pizzo, also Smirking Chimp. As Americans, we've had it drilled into our heads that there are only three kinds of economic models. Capitalism, which we've been Pavlovianly conditioned to accept as the best, most productive, and most democratic economic system ever devised. The current meltdown, we're assured, is simply that exception that proves this rule. Then there's communism, which has repeatedly proven itself the least inefficient and least productive economic system ever devised by man. And then there's socialism, which fans of unfettered capitalism assure us is simply communism in a dress. I only bring this up because today the Republican National Committee, meeting in a spider hole somewhere where they will, in the next few days, demand that the Democratic Party rename itself the Democratic Socialist Party. Well, most of Europe is run by social democrats, and they seem to be doing okay. I mean, no one is doing great these days, but at least Europeans don't have to worry about being unemployed and uninsured. But if the RNC wants to make its case against the Democrats' socialist tendencies, they first have to make a better case for their unfettered capitalistic tendencies. Is pure capitalism really all that efficient? And if so, at what human cost are these efficiencies attained? Fortunately, history provides a report card on American capitalism. And if it were, say, a bus that broke down every 20 miles or so and left its passengers to hoof it into town, I'd suspect we'd replace this thing with something more efficient a long time ago. So here's the report card. October 12, 1837. The panic of 1837, sparked by overextended credit defaults, the House sanctioned the use of Treasury notes for bailout, provided that they didn't exceed $10 million. Congress's efforts to stabilize the nation's currency failed to lift the Depression, which lasted 7 years. Then there's August 24, 1857, 20 years later. Panic spread by the failure of New York branch of the Ohio Life Insurance and Trust Company, which had loaned $5 million to railroad builders, had been swindled out of millions by the manager of its New York branch, and was unable to pay extensive debt to Eastern bankers. Flash forward 22 years to September 24, 1869. Black Friday crash of gold prices as the Grant administration foiled attempts by financiers Jay Gould and James Fisk to try and corner the gold market. Several brokerage firms went bankrupt. National economy was severely disrupted for months. A few years further, September 18, 1873, the Panic of 1873 began with the collapse of Jay Cook & Company, one of the country's most reputable brokerage houses of its time, known as the financier of the Civil War. The Panic of 1873 exposed overspeculation, which continued to wreak havoc on the nation's economy for months. The New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days to wait out the worst of the crises. The Secretary of the Treasury pumped $26 million of new currency into the economy, swelled the amount of paper money in circulation. Panic did not subside. The economy continued its slump through the end of the decade. We go to 1893. Panic was once again sparked due to reckless speculation and over-leveraging. Panic swept the New York Stock Exchange and the stock market crashed. By year's end, the country was in a severe depression. Does any of this sound familiar? November 1903, the Panic of 1903, known as the Rich Man's Panic, reached its low. The Dow dropped to 42.15. Stocks of industrial companies fell to single-digit prices. Fiscal crisis dragged on for the rest of the year and took severe toll on banks, many steel and iron producers. 4 years later, October 1907, the nation plunged into the Panic of 07, which lasted for a year. Sparked by a run on Knickerbocker Trust in New York, which last lacked resources to pay out to the demanding public, ultimately toppling the economy. President Roosevelt enlisted the aid of his one-time enemy, financier J.P. Morgan, who capitalized on his considerable reputation to borrow $1 million in gold from European countries. Outside U.S. sub-treasury building at Wall and Broad Streets in October 07. That must have been a photo. October of 1929, Black Thursday, stock prices plummeted. Oh, by the way, when you're listening to these monetary figures, they don't sound very high compared with figures today, but keep in mind that money was worth a great deal more then. So when he had to borrow $1 million in gold, God knows what that would represent today, but a sizable amount. Okay. More of capitalism's greatest hits, 1929, Black Thursday, stock prices plummeted, a record 12 million shares traded on the New York Stock Exchange, followed by Black Tuesday, the markets tanked. Thousands of investors were wiped out as America's Great Depression began. By 1932, stocks were worth only about 20% of their value in the summer of 29. By the next year, nearly half of America's banks had failed, and unemployment was approaching 15 million people, or 30% of the workforce. One out of three people were out of work. Fast forward to 1985 and 89, the savings and loans collapse, $167 billion in federal bailouts required. 2 years. Then we have October of 87. The stock market crashed as the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 508 points, or 22% in value, its biggest ever percentage drop. Inflation and rising interest rates, the announcement of a surprisingly steep trade deficit, and news of an American attack against Iran were both blamed for Wall Street's woes. Next year, 98, the long-term capital management failure. The Fed had to intervene to avoid sparking a worldwide panic over the condition of giant hedge fund companies like LTCM. 2000, the dot-com bubble crash. 2007, the housing bubble crash. 2008, the toxic assets market crash. Anyway, that's what the history books say. I don't cook them. I just serve them up. That was Stephen Pizzo. The next one by Ted Rall, writing in Smirking Chimp. Excuses you might believe in. Democrats are more powerful than ever. How will they justify doing nothing? The defection of Pennsylvania's Arlen Specter and the imminent certification of Al Franken as the winner of Minnesota's election recount has handed Democrats what they always said they lacked in order to pass a progressive agenda, a filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. Now they face the awful problem of coming up with new excuses for not doing anything. How will Obama, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and the other fake liberals weasel out of making good on their promises for real action on health care, the economy, and the war? It won't be easy. They control both houses of Congress and the White House. Obama is about to fill a new vacancy on the Supreme Court. The Times of London writes that, quote, Mr. Obama, by some assessments, has more political leverage than any president since Franklin Roosevelt in 1937, at the peak of the New Deal, just before he overreached by trying to pack the Supreme Court. The Republican Party, on the other hand, is suffering a crisis of faith, too much God-cheering and not enough adherence to core values, like small government, fiscal conservatism, isolationism, and protectionist trade policy. A mere 21% of Americans still call themselves Republicans, the lowest number since 1983. Similarly, reports the latest ABC News Washington Post poll, just 21% say they're confident in the Republicans in Congress to make the right decisions for the country's future, compared with 60% who expressed that confidence in Obama. Democrats have never been as powerful. Republicans are weak. Obama won with a decisive, sweeping rejection of the Republican status quo. Harry and Louise, call your agents. Socialized medicine is on the way. Not. Be careful what you wish for, what you say you wish for anyway. The left is going to push Obama, now that he's got a veto-proof majority, to drive an agenda that a smart president would realize as a long-term political disaster. This was said by Republican pollster Rick Wilson. Long-term political disaster is mainstream media code for stuff that corporations hate. Well, yes, what passes for the left in this country, center-right everywhere else, because they read, now has some not unreasonable questions for Barack Obama, such as, pretty please, can we now live in a country where people don't have to spend $800 a month to health insurance companies that deny their customers' claims? Why are we still in Iraq? How about some help for the victims of Katrina, many of whom never collected one red cent after losing everything? Why are we paying billions to banks and still letting them gouge us with 25% interest credit card rates? Speaking of which, how about doing something that might actually help people who live in the economy rather than just capital markets? These queries seem all the more relevant, coming as they do from the liberal base of the Democratic Party. You remember the people who got Obama elected? The trouble for our cute, charming Prez is that he has no intention whatsoever of introducing a true national health care plan, one that covers everybody for free. He wants to expand the war in Afghanistan and drag out the one in Iraq. He will not punish Bush or his torturers, rescue homeowners in foreclosure, or nail scumbag banks to the wall. These changes would cost trillions of dollars to multinational insurance companies, defense contractors, and other huge financial concerns who donate generously to candidates of both political parties and have a history of using their clout to manipulate elections in favor of their favorite candidates. A classic example is oil companies, who pushed down gas prices before elections in order to help Republicans. The most that Democratic voters can expect from Democratic politicians is incremental, symbolic change that doesn't cost their corporate sponsors any serious coin. The New York Times marked Obama's 100th day in office with an editorial that approvingly encapsulated his accomplishments to date. Quote, "He's trying to rebuild this country's shattered reputation with his pledge to shut down the prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, his offer to talk with Iran and Syria, and yes, that handshake with Venezuela's blowhard President Hugo Chavez. The government is promoting women's reproductive rights. It is restoring regulations to keep water clean and food safe. The White House has promised to tackle immigration reform this year." Close quote. Trying. Promoting. Has promised. Guantanamo isn't being closed, it's being moved. Gitmo's detainees will be transferred to a new, harsher gulag under construction in Afghanistan. Thawed relations with Iran and Syria would create new business opportunities for big oil. Defending the right to an abortion is popular and doesn't cost Bank of America a dime. Immigration reform is a code for legalizing illegal immigrants, not closing the border. Safety regulations reassure consumers and pump up the economy. Closing the border would raise wages. Corporations won't allow that. Unfortunately for Obama's Democrats, small bore initiatives only go so far, especially with the economy in meltdown. When people are desperate and angry, they don't care as much about flag burning or creationism or a handshake with Hugo Chavez. They want action, real action. How will the Democrats avoid genuine change now that they enjoy the ability to enact it? Will they blame obstructionist Republicans? Will Democrats cross the aisle to vote with the Republicans? A new war, perhaps? If nothing else, whatever dog ate my homework excuse they come up with for sitting on their butts is bound to be amusing, if nothing else. That was Ted Rall writing in Smirking Chimp. I haven't read any Fred Reed in a while. This is Fred Reed. He's got a blog called Fred on Everything. Air power, zooming and booming for the sheer hell of it. Okay, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know about air power. You will never need to read anything else. These revelations will provide blinding insight into our current wars. Here we go. Hold on. The key. Air power is really good for things it's really good for, but works lousily for things it doesn't work well for. If lousily wasn't a word before, it is now. The foregoing is genius incarnate, and would revolutionize military thinking if the Air Force understood it, which it doesn't. As is usual with our late simian species, the fly guy's motivations are instinctual and emotional, with reason a pretext slathered on afterwards and accountability a no-show. Now, it's the cheek among American military reformers and other Fernbar Clausewitz to say wisely that air power is impotent and useless and accomplishes nothing. This is not true. In its own kind of war, it works splendidly. Often it is the only thing that does work. Anyone who thinks that airplanes are pointless gewgaws should talk, say, to Japanese survivors of the Coral Sea in Midway or of Yamato's death run. See, what airplanes are good at is blowing up expensive, visible, identifiable things to include other airplanes. An aircraft air carrier in the open Pacific fits the bill nicely. You can't hide aircraft carriers very well. They don't look like anything else. Even a Marine pilot would never mistake one for an olive orchard, or the cathedral at Chartres, or the Gobi Desert. They just don't look the same. With enough bombing runs, an airplane can hit a carrier, which reduces the number of enemies instead of increasing it. What air power isn't good at is fighting guerrillas and insurgents, especially in populated areas. Why? Well, lots of reasons. First, pilots have no idea what they're bombing. They're flying at 300 miles an hour over countries, often obscured by trees, in which everybody looks exactly like everybody else. So they guess or bomb where the intelligence children tell them are terrorists. Now, the word intelligence sounds much better than bureaucratized clandestine confusion, which is more accurate. The intelligence agencies have enshrouded themselves in an aura of inexorable, good, usually fatal infallibility. My name is Bond, Fred Bond. This is good PR, it's little else. These are the same intelligence agencies, remember, that didn't know where the Japanese fleet was in 1941, despite rumblings of war, agencies that were taken by surprise by the North Korean attack in 1950, and then by the Chinese entry into that war, that didn't anticipate the behavior of the Vietnamese in that war, despite Bernard Falls' books and the highly documented experience of the French. When the military made a well-executed raid into Hanoi to free American prisoners at Son Tay, the intel people hadn't noticed the prisoners had been moved. They were surprised when the Berlin Wall went up, and then again when it came down. They failed to foresee the collapse of the Soviet Union. Their reason for existence was to know about the Soviet Union, by the way. They missed on 9/11. Earlier, when the Air Force bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, it was because the spooks didn't know where the embassy was that day. Granted, embassies are hard to locate. They roll about on wheels, creep down alleys at night, and wear dark-colored clothing, that sort of thing. The intel weenies also didn't foresee the behavior of either Iraqis or Afghans, despite great archives of historical evidence, unless you think the U.S. knew about those upcoming messes and invaded anyway, and so on. These are the geniuses picking targets. You see the problem? Now, we read a lot of PR about surgical strikes and precision weapons. Think carefully about this. Intel says a terrorist leader of indescribable potency is in a house in a flimsily constructed suburb. The Air Force then makes a surgical strike with a 500-pound bomb, taking out half a block. Pretty surgical, that. Perhaps it was the right block. It is possible. But it still kills 75 people. The male relatives of the dead then join the insurgency. Rah, rah, air power. The Air Force can't afford to understand this, as then it would have to find a day job. So why does the Air Force engage in counterproductive tactics with totally inappropriate airplanes? Because it's the only kind of airplanes it has. Why? Because fast, screaming, roaring, flashy Zoom buggies with lots of screens and switches and rockets are fun. Never, ever underestimate fun as a driver of military policy. A hot fighter is the world's pizzazziest, priciest, swishiest video game. An airborne dirt bike with all the fixins. Really? You may think I'm trying to be snotty and clever. Think again. All right, I am trying to be snotty and clever, but what I'm saying is still true. Do you think I spent 30 years covering the military because I wanted to butcher puzzled third-word illiterates tending goats? No, it was fun. Low-level pop-and-drops in an F-16 out of Shaw Air Force Base, F-15 air-to-air against Guard A-7s over Holloman, bomb runs at 400 feet over hazy Wyoming badlands, like the doorway to hell in a B-52. God, what a freaking trip! Far better than growing up. Snazzy mask and helmet, 5G turns with your face flowing back behind your ears, world going inverted, burners kicking in. Woo-ha! It's not called a joystick for nothing. And jet jocks get paid to do this. Whether it serves a practical purpose doesn't matter. Not with rides like those. If you think those things don't matter, you're out of your mind. However, the glory days are coming to a close. Fighter guys are now in the position of cavalry in 1914, addicted to the noble horse, but in an age of machine guns, wire entanglements, and massed artillery, as viable as slide rulers in Santa Clara. The reason is the armed drone, the Predator being a good example. These things now have the range, optronics, data links, and so on to carry serious missiles to hit the wrong targets and piss off entire populations, as well as real horses, fighter planes. They're lots cheaper than piloted whiz gizmos, and the bloodless, unaccountable CIA geek in Colorado or wherever can fly them. Same stupid effect, but none of the fun. Call it anti-chivalry. Death by nerds without souls. In a century, we've gone from Baron von Richthofen to a dinosaur eyeing a thin crust of ice forming on his swamp and thinking, this can't be good. See, now you understand air power. Fred Reed, writing in Fred on Everything. A farmer had some puppies he needed to sell. He painted a sign advertising the four pups and set about nailing it to a post on the edge of his property. As he was driving the last nail into the post, he felt a tug on his overalls. He looked down into the eyes of a little boy. "Mister," he said, "I want to buy one of your puppies." "Well," said the farmer, as he rubbed the sweat off the back of his neck, "these puppies come from fine parents and cost a good deal of money." The boy dropped his head for a moment, then reaching deep into his pocket, he pulled out a handful of change and held it up to the farmer. "I got 39 cents. Is that enough to take a look?" "Sure," said the farmer. And with that, he let out a whistle. "Here, Dolly." Out from the doghouse and down the ramp ran Dolly, followed by four little balls of fur. The little boy pressed his face against the chain-link fence. His eyes danced with delight. As the dogs made their way to the fence, the little boy noticed something else stirring. Inside the doghouse, slowly, another little ball appeared, this one noticeably smaller. Down the ramp it slid. Then, in a somewhat awkward manner, the little pup began hobbling toward the others, doing its best to catch up. "I want that one," the little boy said, pointing to the runt. The farmer knelt down at the boy's side and said, "Son, you don't want that puppy. He will never be able to run and play with you like the other dogs would." With that, the little boy stepped back from the fence, reached down, and began rolling up one leg of his trousers. In doing so, he revealed a steel brace running down both sides of his leg, attaching itself to a specially made shoe. Looking back up at the farmer, he said, "Well, sir, I don't run too well myself, and he'll need someone who understands." With tears in his eyes, the farmer reached down and picked up the little pup. Holding it carefully, he handed it to the little boy. "How much?" asked the little boy. "No charge." "There's no charge for love. There are plenty of